Okay, it's July 6, 2003, Toronto to New York, and this is Bob talking with Simon. Here he is.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Simon.
How are you?
Okay, it took you a while to connect.
Yes, it did. Actually, we've been trying to get this entire conversation to happen for some time.
Right.
I've been busy at my ridiculous television job.
Well, there's a good topic. What kind of position do you have?
I spend the money on the TV show, so I'm in production, that side of it. And my job is to sort of make sure that the thing comes in on time, on budget. It's called a production manager. So it's something I've been doing for a few years. And
do you call it ridiculous?
Oh, because I don't watch TV.
this is right up my alley.
I know. I've talked with Matt about you before, and actually, I know Matt's thinking of, well, have you guys sold it yet, your TV? Yeah?
Oh,
yeah. You're going to sell it, aren't you? Get rid of it?
No one wants it.
It's about time. So, yeah, no, what I did, Bob, was I cut my TV off after, because I wanted to afford flying lessons.
Yeah.
And so I turned off the TV, canceled the gym memberships, and now I got a bit of a pot belly, but a free mind. And basically, I finished the flying lessons and realized I didn't miss the TV at all. And then I realized, hell, I work in a TV business. So I kind of got this idea in my head that I was sort of like a drug dealer who doesn't get high in his own supply.
Right. Now, this is the key issue. I don't know how much you know of what I've said before, but I've said stuff on the previous 7 dialogues with other people, and what I'm going to say is consistent with what I said before. We'll find out how much background you need. The point is that television, any new media we make, especially electronic media, are parts of our bodies. They become parts of our bodies. So just as you have to eat, collectively society needs to use TV once it's here. So you often eat indifferently. And someone grows you the food and you eat it and you just got to keep doing it. Well, we have to keep making TV programs on that level of understanding that people, it is part of our bodies, it has to be, it's part of our nature now, and it has to be processed. So yes, you can be indifferent to your personal use of TV, but collectively people need TV, so it's going to keep being manufactured.
Of course. There's the programming that we make, I can't figure out a single purpose for it.
But I've given you the purpose. If you understand that people, there's no purpose in me breathing every day. When
right.
I wake up, I've got to use my senses. They get used regardless of my opinions. The mind starts thinking about what it should do with this body in different ways, you know. Ignore it, kill it, withdraw from it in some way. The thing is, I can't get rid of it, basically, unless I do a drastic act. That's what I mean. There's no point to, in particular, understanding. I mean, maybe there's a big point from the creator's point of view, whatever. Or whatever.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. But the thing is that there's no point in the TV programming. You just must continue breathing, and part of our breathing apparatus is the TV environment, and plus the new chip body.
Well, and the appetite is constantly growing, it seems, because there are more and more diversification of the channel, the world out there. You can fine-tune your viewing to, if you want to watch nothing but golf, there it is. If you want to watch nothing but shows on airplanes, it's there too.
Now here's an interesting point. When TV came in the 50s, we didn't have what you just described. It's the digitalization and computerized and satellization and fiber opticization that has allowed that main medium of TV in the 50s and 60s to be niche marketed, demographically marketed, and spread all over the world for different cultures that were just beginning to have radio. So the variety, the micro content of TV channels is TV as the old environment being molded to the digital new environment. And the digital, it creates a more one-on-one relationship of media consumption. So I would say that the targeting of whole channels on golf or whole channels on chess or whatever is for people as they go through, let's think of these new countries that are getting TV, they're going to go through the standardized American product or Chinese product, whatever the national product is. Then as they get more used to the digital technology, which is creeping up around their beginning use of TV, they will want maybe more specialized TV programming. And then it'll get more and more specialized. So over time, they'll eventually get to having golf, Chinese golf channels, but it'll be en route to people getting to the point you and many affluent Americans have gotten over the last 30 years, indifferent to TV, indifferent to the programming. So the niche marketing to one kind of thing is a phase of the population realizing that TV doesn't matter.
Most so is the natural extension that of that process then to do something like I've done, which is to turn it off?
Yeah. That's what was interesting is TV was new for boomers and the older Depression generation. They had to go through the first phase of mass TV in the 50s and 60s. But McLuhan predicted, you know who Marsh McLuhan is?
Yes.
Yeah, he predicted in an interview in somewhere in the middle 70s, might even been the late 70s, he used to advocate TV being turned off in the 60s as a collective governmental act just for 6 months because of it was the highest decibels of consciousness and just fucked up all the previous institutions. So as an ecological strategy, let's turn it off, he said, for 6 months. But by the end of the 70s, he was saying that the, we'll call the Generation X, the ones who grew up after the baby boomers in the 60s, 70s in TV, which I assume you're part of, or maybe you've been younger than
I'm about 30.
Right, so you're in between Generation X and Y. But the thing is that you and some of the Generation Xers got so much TV compared to the baby boomers that they naturally turned off. He said in their late teens they'll be oversaturated and they'll drop out of TV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, he was saying that right around the late 70s, right when punk came in. And the popularity of punk was, that was a movement that was against all mass media imagery. The Beatles thought that they, and the rock guys thought that they could communicate a message within the mass media and change people in the 60s. But the excessive use of TV provided to the punk generation made them more aware of the futility of mass media communication, and so the punk ethos was screw all attempts to mass media, do a fake movement, a fake media movement. So that came in the late 70s, right when McLuhan was saying that the punk generation, he wasn't using that term, but he meant those younger kids, would be turned off, would be saturated when drop out looking for other media. Now, it wasn't until the personal computer came along that they had a new medium to do. And so then that, in the late 80s and 90s, created a new activity of the hacker generation going around the old TV. But so we're left with what I call the TV body, which as it's gotten miniaturized, it becomes part of our organs. It's acknowledged as an organ, it's a stabilizing, conserving medium, and the chip is for improvisation. The chip body is a new organ attached to us, and that is the one that we can find novelty in any form, one to many, many to many, many to one, any kind of broadcasting, it's interactive. I would say the chip body sensibility is what you had to process, and it was easy to drop the TV in your own expending your time, but you still have collectively and personally still need to check the TV every now and then to say some major news story. You need to process it. But society in general has got to process it anyways. So TV is the conserving body. The chip body is the anarchist individualist body. Or now I'm using the word body. I would say it's a new organ in our previous bodies. It's changed the shape of our body.
You're right, though, Bob. I do check in with television. And
you do, let's go into this. You do feel that you need to occasionally, right?
I'll tell you a case in point. I was just in Japan. And I was in Japan when the military action started recently in Iraq.
Yeah.
And I had flown to Japan on the day that they had said the war would basically be starting.
Right. You were flying while knowing that.
That's right.
Were you nervous?
Yes, I actually was, and I knew that it was totally irrational, and I knew that there was no chance that anything would be going on with the aircraft that I was in, but I still had that fear,
right.
And I recognized that that was probably a good thing as far as the people who were, you know, orchestrating the war were concerned. They want you to be afraid, they want you to check in, and they want you to make sure that you're going to be safe.
Yeah.
So I get to Japan, and I spent the first part of my time in this brand new culture and country, finding an English newspaper, trying to find the BBC Worldwide Service to see what was going on. And I realized that I was defeating the whole point of my visit there, which was to get away from all this crap. And we saw the BBC World News. A lot of that was around. And I actually noticed a difference between the kinds of reporting that you would see on CNN and the versus the kinds of reporting you would see on BBC News. You know, there were stories about the bad things that the American forces were doing, which I just would never hear over here.
So
it was interesting that there is a bit of a difference in the content if you travel around the world in what's on the television vis-a-vis news stories, etc. But it just didn't seem to really matter to me because I was just hungry for information on what was going on, where the forces were right now. And I didn't care that, you know, a bunch of American soldiers apparently pulled over some people in the car and shot them dead. Sorry, that I would never hear here. Didn't seem to matter to me. You know, you start to think, well, that's war. But it was an interesting thing that I was trying to basically put myself back in a position where I was at home again.
Right.
Trying to be informed, and my mother was calling, my father was calling, how's everything going? Well, for God's sake. And then the SARS thing happened on the way back.
Were you there when that happened?
I was in Japan when the first case of SARS was being reported in Toronto. And my parents were saying to me over the telephone, oh, you know what, it'd be great, you know, you should be careful because this is an Asian thing. And of course it turns out that Toronto was the one of the hardest hit places in the world.
But wait, you said you were in Japan when you were heard that it hit
in Toronto.
Was it known then?
Supposedly
that it
come over from, I believe it was Hong Kong.
Right. There wasn't any attachment to Japan at that point.
No, there were no patients in Japan with the disease, and I don't know if there ever have been.
Right.
Actually.
So your parents were saying you were safe in Japan?
No, they were saying it's an Asian problem, and that's the limit of their perspective.
Oh, they were worried. Right.
Yeah. So it turns out that on the way back on the plane, I was also frightened about picking up symptoms of this disease.
Yeah.
So both trips, there and back, worried about totally different things, focused on some kind of ridiculous news story in both cases.
No, this is really good. And also, I think I remember now, you're the person who discovered the significance of cell phones.
That's right. I was going to tell you that story.
Well, we'll get to that. Because
okay.
This is really, really good information to prove my point or to help understand my point. When I say TV is the conserving part of our organism now, which has a physical body, a spiritual astral body, this new TV part, and then the chip body. The TV part is conserving. That's where nations, this old obsolete structure called the nation, still uses TV to propagate that it is still here and that its issues are important. The nation can't do anything about the chip body, where people are broadcasting instantly all over the world, interacting one-on-one beyond any national standards, right? They can't control that market, that environment. So therefore, the nations have big spectaculars like the G8 meeting. Aren't you having that in Canada right now, G7 or some summit?
Not certain.
Not certain, yeah. I think there's something going on in Canada recently, last week or so. But that's where the news gives a lot of coverage, right? The swarm, the pack goes over there and covers some old institutional gathering. That's the function of TV. Now, that is part of us. That's part of our history, and we can't get rid of it. And it's part of our organism, just as much as we need food. So that when one nation goes in a war to another, you, largely living in an internet or non-TV world, even though you're producing professionally TV programs, you personally are not interacting too much with the old TV environment. You're off in the chip or the cell phone or whatever you do that's not TV. The thing is that when you heard about the war, you had to find out what the nations had to say about it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you had to log back into a part of yourself that the chip body can put on hold and put it aside like a subconscious.
Yeah, that's a good phrase, log in, because that's what it felt like in a way.
Yeah, you logged in because the chip is the real environment today. The TV is the old environment. So you logged, used the present environment's new slang, new terms that it creates. New environments always create new words. And you apply it back to the old media, the old parts of the body, like the TV. So you log back into the TV zone. You can see that on my chart. But the interesting thing is that those were problems. The TV body deals with the idea there are peoples, there are nations, and they are have image relationships to each other. This is the whole dominance of the PR. Why national news desks like CBC or NBC, CBS, they cannot defame the public image of the president or something. That's why you have the Teflon effect started coming with Reagan, that the president can get away with a lot of what seem to be scandals, and the major media will not report it because they're a conserving medium now. Their main thing is just to keep alive the image that there are nations and that there are peoples, when in actual fact, the chip reality makes us all in little subatomic particles that have no boundaries in any form, and that is where we live, and therefore the anarchy, the cyclotron, particle chamber, particle accelerator life we live on the chip is where we're really at, and the older media is easy to drop off from because of its role of preserving people. Now, the image of people that they preserve is not really what we are made up of. So,
do you mean that the image that we're seeing is more an echo than anything else of something that...
An after image.
It's gone by?
Right.
Yeah.
When you see anybody on a TV or movie screen, they show the normal physical body. But that is not what our bodies consist of anymore. We have new lungs, which are the TV. We have new stomachs, which is the chip body. I'm just using old biological terms to refer to new apparatuses that are part of our body now. And our body is, I mean, you know, the cyborg is a popular expression of that. The idea, the Terminator is a guy who's half machine, half data, half flesh, or one-third each. But that we're even more than that. We're these huge environments. So when you see anybody being shown on media or movies, that's not what we are. So it's already a delusion, a red herring, a rearview mirror, all right? The entity that was flying to Tokyo, is that where you went?
Yeah, I flew into, actually I flew out of Tokyo. I flew into Kix, which is in Osaka.
Oh, okay. So the entity flying in there is made up of a physical body, an astral body, and this huge TV environment, which is miniaturized, symbolized by the kids tattooing themselves. The tattoos, and even middle-aged people, everybody tattoos themselves now. The tattoo represents the TV body. The chip body is represented by the stud put in the nose, genitals, or ear, or whatever, or nipples, right? That's a symbol of the chip. So if we saw you with tattoos and studs, we would then see, well, those are symbolic representations of what you really were. So the entity that flew in the plane is this weird pattern of information that is not limited to a physical body. That is what responded and heard a call from its quark parents.
Yep.
You see, quark parents, and they had instant access to you. They're always inside you. And once you have the electric gauge, we're inside each other. So this landscape, the interior landscape, they don't teach in medicine yet. And it may sound crazy, but that's what we're doing. We're dealing with that. These are body processes that have to be continually processed. But you see, the TV, the conserving body, the TV was our parent, we could say, for everybody born in the 50s, 60s, and on. Once you have the chip environment, you leave your parent. But the parent still has problems, still has legacies of its own history. And so George Bush represents the parent image of the United States up against some other country's images. You see what I'm saying?
I do, yeah.
So there's the structure. So let's go into how you thought the cell phones, when I said on Cloak and Dagger that the cell phone was the cause of September 11th, you didn't think that was right.
No, I don't think I said that. I actually had an experience in Tokyo.
But that's later. Didn't you make us, or maybe you didn't tell Matt, I just...
Did I? I don't, that may have been so long ago, I don't remember, Bob, but I'm sure that sounds like the kind of thing that I might have said, what is he talking about, too?
Right.
So, go ahead, explain that to me.
He pointed that out when you came back. He said, oh, this guy realizes what you meant, and that's what I'm thinking of.
Okay. So
what happened when you were over there?
When I was over there, I noticed, first of all, the cell phone over there is... seems a bit further ahead, technology-wise, and the people. Full color screens. Basically, they've got music can play, and rather than just shrill little notes, you can play actual songs.
Right on their little phone.
Yeah, and there's cameras in them, and now you're starting to see them here as well.
Right.
But this, and that was only a few months ago. You just couldn't, they weren't here. Now I get back and they're starting to appear here and there.
Yes.
There are games on them. There are calendars. It's basically become a personal data device.
So when you went to Japan, it's not necessarily the physical body culture. It's anthropological culture. It was its real culture, which is being on the leading edge of new gadgets. That, see, when people go to a new country, they have the shock of, they have what's called culture shock. They see a culture so different from their own. But what was interesting is that you saw a variation on the cell phone or chip body. That's what's communicated to you as different.
Yeah, but the thing about it was that it actually frightened me because here's the story. I'm on the bus. I'm going home one night with my friend, and I guess we were in Tokyo, and there's a guy sitting there with his cell phone. He's asleep, and his cell phone is cradled in his arm as though it were, let's say, a baby cat.
Yes.
And this thing could have fit easily, of course, in his pocket, but he had fallen asleep with it in his arm, cradled as if he were waiting for some kind of a phone call or an email or something.
Right.
But it's become something that he needs to take care of, that he needs to ensure is on and is charged and ready to receive the communication, whatever that is, that he expects to get. And he keeps it close to himself. And it's interesting, you know, very close to his stomach. And you talk about the feeding analogy. So I looked at that guy and I just thought, oh my God, these people, and you see them standing at the bus stops too, all of them have the cell phone raised up to sort of eye level, and they're playing a game or they're writing an email or something at the bus stop. And there's about four or five people at the bus stop, and, you know, the majority of them have these phones, and they're just standing there. And the bus comes, they put them down, they get on, they sit in their seats, and they play with them again. And it shocked me because my cell phone, I do have one, I use primarily to talk to people with. That's it. But I'm starting to see that the approach is to get people to do a lot more than that with this piece of technology, and I don't want to do that.
Right. Now, there's the dilemma. As you watch people get virtualized or get involved with the new organs in their body. Now, what's interesting, when the telephone came out, 1880s, 1890s, there were management courses on how to use the telephone.
Okay, yeah.
We don't realize how much we become used to technologies that were like alien invaders, you know, when they first arrived. They always create a shock to the culture that's used to older technologies, previous technologies. So they had to have courses on how to use a telephone, which sounds absurd to us. Also, when there were many memos that went around when the telephone was first patented about how could industries use it, and nobody could think of how to use it. They said, there's no, I don't see how we can use this. It doesn't have any applications that we can fit into our industry. But eventually, this telephone became an environment. People were buying it, and then it was used, and people used it to yak and chatter. So what's really going on here? This is the important meaning of the phrase phatic communion. Phatic is a term from linguistics, which means, in the dictionary, it'll say a communication of general sociability or general amiability. It's like when you're at work and you see somebody and you say, how you doing?
Yep.
They don't tell you how they're doing. They'll just say, how you doing back. It's a way of the semantic meaning of the words are not applicable. It's just a way of waving or acknowledging the person. And that's very important in culture, that kind of communication. So that's called phatic communication, as opposed to emphatic, which means you have a particular meaning the other person has to match with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what people didn't realize is that because these new technologies like telephone are organic and are like breathing, we would use them just like we eat food. And we would engage in a lot of discussion that didn't have matchable purposes. Matching is what you do when you do science, where you lay out an experiment and it has to match with the previous experiment, or if you discover something new, that has to be repeatable. This is like emphatic communication. One thing, one word means one thing, and we're trying to find out how to apply it. That was a purely literate print world effect. But once you got into the electric phase, you could communicate where matching was not important. You could just keep humming and awing. And another meaning of of phatic is that when we're talking and you go, mm-hmm, to me, that means you're telling me to keep going. That's a phatic expression, mm-hmm.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So people didn't realize that. Illiterate society did not know that one could use their mouth and eyes and communicate phatically, that it was an important human function. And the phrase phatic communion was invented by an anthropologist who went to the Pacific Ocean, Bronowski, and he noticed this something about the way the tribes held themselves together that wasn't based on meaning being exchanged in a matchable sense, and he coined the phrase phatic for this strange phenomenon that tribal cultures had, preliterate cultures had. He that was significant to him, and it came back, and it was an important discovery. It was written up in a book called The Meaning of Meaning, which had a big influence on James Joyce and Marcel Duchamp, two of the greatest artists of the 20th century, who used phatic communication as part of their writing and painting and artwork. So literate person was astounded by phatic communication in tribal cultures, but as we were being retribalized in the electronic age, we became increasingly phatic. So you see these people on these cell phones in Japan using these things just like they were breathing, and going to keep doing it, and they're not doing it for any immediate purpose of matching information. They're just swimming in it. Phatic is like swimming in your senses.
Yeah, right, but that can't be good.
Ah, wait, it can't be good for literate societies, all right? It happened a long time ago in tribal societies, and they survived for thousands of years. They just got wiped out when literacy came on. Literacy was printing press societies were just such a different kind of society, an aberration. Talk about aliens. These were aliens. Interesting that the native South Americans, Aztecs and that, thought that the Columbus and these guys were fulfilling their alien prophecies. But they imagined some aliens coming from another planet. They didn't know that these were coming from an alien medium, the printing press, which would cause this weird world of the last 300, 400 years.
Right.
But the literate society is now has their identity threatened because we've retrieved tribal phatic communion, which is a threat to literate societies who demand meaningful or matchable communication. I don't mean meaningful in an archetypal or spiritual way. It means practical, efficient communication. Like jazz coming out of tribal societies. They are improvising. They weren't following the score. The score was written in classical music and had to be followed. The idea of improvising, that was shocking at first. It was considered brothel music. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
But they were beginning to improvise. Now it's accepted by the baby boomers and following generations as a natural ability. As a matter of fact, you have to be able to improvise to rap, hip-hop, rant, make it up, perform in the younger cultures, or you're not cool. But if someone from 70, 80 years ago saw this, they would consider it pagan, idolatrous, barbaric, but not so long. So what's interesting is that you work in an efficient causality job. You have to produce on time. You're still following the accounting procedures of literate society. You have to keep on budget, on the bottom line.
That's right.
So you would generally conditioned by that thinking, even though you live on emphatically in, at other times, but on your job, and that's your main function going over there, I would say it's your job self, one of your many selves, that was shocked by this inefficient communication going on.
Hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the advent of reality television, for instance.
Right. Now, that'd be interesting. Here's you. You're involved in business before that came?
Yeah, just on the cusp of it, really. I don't know what you would consider the beginning of it, but, I mean, in our business, I think the show Survivor may have been the one that everybody felt really pushed the ship out of the shore.
Yeah, so you had to deal with that. You had to deal with the change in your business.
Yes,
so
at that point.
So what happened to you there?
Well, there we were sat down and said, let's think of ideas like that.
Was it true that it was due to budget problems, that you don't need to have unionized actors, that you...
Interesting.
You know, all the supposed economic reasons why TV went that way here in the States, which began everything, or maybe it was Britain, but the major media before you come to Toronto, were those factors that you considered, or you just had to do it?
No, we at that point, because we're a Canadian company that tends to look to the States for direction in the way things are going, we had no choice but to try and think of ideas that could emulate that. But
there's
that
is the centralizing reality of the TV body, collectively, isn't it? That you are controlled by New York in that sense.
We are, but the truth of the matter is, and you did just mention this briefly, that the idea for the show Survivor came from Europe. I believe it was a British show, and,
yeah.
and possibly previously to that, I think it may have been also in Norway or someplace like that.
Right.
Oh, that's right, and the game shows were going on then, too. You remember we had that craze with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and
yes.
that sort of thing. That also came from England.
But was it, do you know, speaking as an industry person, that Britain had to do that for budget reasons?
Well, definitely it's cheaper to produce that kind of programming because you're not paying actors, because you're not shooting on film stock, you're shooting on video.
Yeah.
And the post-production of that stuff is a lot cheaper, and as well as the production. You know, in video land, you don't need a lot of lights to shoot. So you're just out there with your crew, and you're on a hot, sunny island, of course, so there's plenty of available lights, so that's cheap. You don't have to bring any in. You know, you want to shoot at night? Oh, we'll just light a few torches. That fits with the setting. So it's very cheap to do.
Okay, so now we get into another thing I've mentioned, I think, on previous talks. Aristotle had four kinds of causality. Like, when you look at the causes of things, reality happening, he had formal causality, he had material causality, efficient causality, and final causality. We don't need to go into what each one really meant, the philosophical points that he made about them, but the four kinds of causality, McLuhan retrieved. They'd been forgotten during the science phase of the Gutenberg galaxy, say, from 1600 to 1900. They had referenced, that period referenced material causality and efficient causality, what the thing is made up of, and how it is, how it functions. That's efficient causality, how you make it function. The practical level, or being pragmatic. So the formal causality, the effects of printing press and new technologies on people was ignored. McLuhan brought back the full four causes. So when we talk about this survivor syndrome, and I brought up the efficient causality, the budget reasons for it, right?
Right.
But there also had to be formal causality reasons, why it struck a nerve in the audience.
Right, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Probably the most interesting question.
Right, well, that's what everybody, nowadays the electric media has brought back interest in formal causality because the media is run on polls and where the audience is at and mirroring it back to them.
Right.
So that is the key causality. That's the post-scientific, post-Gutenberg scientific, post-Newtonian scientific world we're in now. So the formal causality in this case is what I had predicted, is that as technology got miniaturized in the digital phase, where you have a person, like this Japanese person who has music, you know, radio, TV, computer, email, newspapers and books, all in the palm of his hand. These were previously, over the last 200 years, massive media environments. Telegraph, newspaper, movie, radio. Huge environments that caused wars and did all kinds of things. They're miniaturized. So we see the trend is toward miniaturizing massive media environments. The miniaturization then means that you end up with a body that is autonomous in a lot of ways compared to previous cultures from media environments, media massages. So the retrieval of the body, and of course I would have to update that image of the body because I have to contain the new organs, TV, and chip, but let's just take the image of the body see in survival. These people are in a new wilderness where they have access with their Palm Pilots and cell phones to everything media-wise, but they are confronting the bodies that all these technologies were extensions of. And as they miniaturized, you're left with the thing that everything was extended from, the physical body. So in the late 90s, the physical body is the thing that's being picked up by collective consciousness as where we're really at. See, entertainment always is riding on certain formal causality effects that of new technologies that people aren't seeing. But the arts and sciences always respond to this, and the public responds to those things because it's all a kind of recognition of a common sensibility that's surfacing. So the using of untrained people, of body interaction and survival stresses and strains, would be totally a product of virtual reality, which was surfacing in the 80s and 90s, virtual reality media, because anybody could make music, anybody could do this, anybody could do that with their computers. So the old professions of entertainment, music and art and painting were obsolete. And that would include actors, because even the president even an actor became a president. So therefore, if acting as a discipline disappeared, then you don't need actors as a result of the virtual reality situation, and therefore you'd come to people who weren't specifically trained as actors. All those are environmental effects of the 80s and 90s that led to the popular response to these kind of reality TV shows. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
See, so that's the formal causality reason why it worked. Because remember, they had reality TV on MTV for 10 years, right? That teen show.
Which one was that?
I think it was called Real TV or something. I'm not sure.
Oh, right. They're driving around in the van and going to... Yeah, that's right. They just sort of did the road trip job with the kids in the van.
Yeah. And that was 10 years ago.
Yeah, that was a while back. You're right. I've forgotten about that one entirely.
Yeah, so what you have is anthropologists always, when they study tribes, they found out that tribal elders watched the kids, because the kids always seemed to pick up, because their senses were fresher, their intuition was fresher, what was going on. So society always looked at kids, began in the 50s with studying, quote, teenagers, a new word in the 50s, and seeing what you could market to them. The kids are always picking up and expressing things that are going on before it becomes a massive thing. So MTV, a youth medium supposedly 10 years ago, was picking up on the digital formal causality effect of the return of the body by having reality TV. But it wasn't the mass thing that was happening for the whole planet by the late 90s, and there you have it.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Who is wielding this force at this point? Where are these types of efforts leading us to? The return of the body, all that sort of thing, watching the younger generation to make sure that we know what is going to be in the forefront of everyone's mind and how to capitalize on that.
Right.
Who's taking care of that job?
Okay. We're going to have to apply four causalities here, four levels here. The formal causality is that human beings are constantly creating new media environments. So we are doing it to ourselves. Now, in the West, we have an individualist society based on money, which came in with uniform markets created by the printing press. So we have what's called capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep that individualist consumer thing going. So we interpret the formal effects of new massive environments like the cell phone. We interpret it within our cultural prerogative of capitalism. So we must market media content disguised as entertainment to different age groups, and one of them is kids. So you will always have marketing people in the Western context looking at kids.
Right. They call them cool hunters. Yeah.
What'd you call them?
Cool hunters.
Right. Have you ever, did you see that PBS documentary featured Douglas Rushkoff?
I may have seen that. I've also read a little book on it as well.
Right.
And it's an interesting field of marketing, but it's a bit despicable, I think, also.
It's despicable from what perspective? Like, as a Westerner, you live in that society, that's what has to be done. But you aren't a Westerner under chip conditions. You are everywhere on the planet and in the universe, all right, because you are inside everybody on the planet. And from that globalist perspective, yes, it seems to be like piranha feeding on people.
Yeah.
And but you're also speaking from certain values that came out of the Western society, the Enlightenment values of individuality, individual sovereignty, individual development, and democratic rights, and freedom to divide, to determine reality.
Yeah, you know, you're going to touch on something I was thinking about not so long ago, is that I am a product myself.
Yes.
Of a product. So I'm aware, and I have been doing some thinking recently about where my initial reactions are coming from. Well, it's coming from the fact that I'm a North American. First of all, I'm a white male living in North America with a full-time job, who has access to all this media. So, of course, something that I think is despicable or deplorable here may not hold true elsewhere.
Right. And you can understand that more today because you're not limited to that cultural blinder, which people were 50 and 100 and all the way back in history. No one could see other tribe. But you travel through all these new media and confront images of other tribes, other actions all the time. So you're a lot more aware of your own cultural bias, because that's only one part of your body, so to speak, now. You see what I'm saying? That you're expressing that awareness of the limitations is a product of the fact you don't live in that one little culture anymore.
Exactly, and even articulating that to you is probably absolutely redundant at this point.
Right, right. It, now, the reason, the only reason it's not redundant is that there is an industrial structure built in the West that must be serviced by the oil industry in general. And that is only one part of our society and one part of our body. But it's up against a TV interior landscape and then a chip landscape, which can go around the TV interior landscape. So you have to, you personally have to process those three environments, the industrial, the TV, and the chip. And they've been built, they're here, and they're not limited to national categories or national definitions anymore. That's why the TV body became very severe about political correctness, because those old tribal identities, which didn't really exist under chip body conditions, still existed as part of the old industrial structure, therefore were the content of the conserving TV body, and the TV body, as a kind of high priest of remembering these old environments, must insist on being politically correct, because it's hoiking up tribal images, which are after images of people who have tribes who have become actually quarks, and has to preserve those images.
Yeah, it's a bit like a bit like a tradition.
Yes, right. The TV is the conserving medium, and if they want to make us think there are still bodies and people and nations, and crowds and races, and therefore they will that you can be fired like Andy Rooney, 60 Minutes, or anybody if you go on the TV body and are politically, racially incorrect. Then you are violating the rules of that environment, that part of our body. And that's you are excised, excommunicated. And it only applies there. On the net, you can say anything, all right? There's the most, quote, evil, racist, whatever is on there, communicating among themselves. No one can police that. But if one of those racists gets on TV, they got to be careful. If they want to survive within the TV world, they have to cover what they mean and patch it over.
But now you're talking about the Internet, doing whatever you want. And, of course, as you, I'm sure, know, the music industry is fighting all these file sharers.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, that's a traditional old body of or organ trying to clamp down a new one.
Using the Western literate tradition of individual ownership of intellectual property rights.
Right.
That sovereignty that was built up with the printing press, because you would read alone, and that all comes from the Gutenberg heritage.
But they're using the old tools.
They're using
the system.
That's right. They're using what's the old stuff and refusing to define the new technologies that they fund. All our money goes to funding inventions through taxes and government and making new technologies. We refuse to acknowledge the characteristics of the new technology, which contradict the old bodies. So
in a way, it's like similar to the phrase that the revolution eats its children.
Say that again?
The revolution eats its children.
Right, right. And that's the history of technology. The printing press ate the medieval era. The telegraph ate the printing press. Television ate the movies. And then the digital ate TV. That's the way we evolved. But we can recognize that pattern now and define our political terms, our public terms, better than what we're doing. We should all acknowledge we're quadriphenic, that we have these four body parts, that we have to juggle them. They're not only in us. They represent collective environments that are like nature that we have to process. Instead of saying that we in the United States represent democratic values or individual rights and human rights and all these things are only a period specific, a product of certain technological phases.
Are you suggesting coexistence?
I think that's where we're... coexistence implies a balance.
You had said juggle.
Yes. We have to juggle because more is continuing to come down the pike to be developed. It's almost like we can't establish a point of equilibrium, a balance point. We always are trying to get a balance, and we excessively attempt publicly, privately, to say we're working towards balance, but the hypocrisy there is that you cannot have balance in this situation. We are in the age of chaos. That's why the popularity of the notion of chaos. Why physics got into chaos. Physics is an old Gutenbergian image of nature, and then it had to adapt to the electric effect, which was chaotic. I have McLuhan on my chart as the chaos phase, dealing with the era of chaos. So now it's a cliche, but you have most of our media content is people providing imageries and styles of balance orientation, from Oprah to the Group of Seven meetings. There's nothing but an eternal dialogue guided toward towards equilibrium. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So coexistence is what we want to get, but you can't strive for it in a simple, literate way. You have to recognize, you have to become a yogi who has to balance these new energy forms inside their body that have grown like, new monster movies, alien organisms that have grown inside us. We've got to learn to recognize we have them and talk about it. So my wife now has a new updated website which talks about the five bodies, and she's speaking as a doctor, that the four bodies, five is a special number, I'll just say four, the four bodies have to be acknowledged by doctors, both alternative and allopathic, in helping people to regulate their health, because you can't just limit yourself to the health that your physical body needs. You need to figure out how the chip body and TV body are stomachs that need to be fed, and how are you going to feed them and create a coexistence of the time using those body organs in relation to the needs of your physical original body. So the cliche is the nerd, the geek, the techno geek who spends hours, days, programming software and eating Twinkies or Pop or something, right?
Yep.
Living off junk food.
There's taking care of the one body.
Yeah, he or she is only taking care of the chip body. And that's a very important point. And he might think that's what we're going to lose all those bodies, lose the older bodies and go into a chip world. But at this point, we aren't. And so we've got to coordinate it. But you can't, the ones who are into organic food and natural eating aren't aware of their chip stomachs that are impressing upon them. So when they raise their kids, they try to make them vegetarian or whatever, they don't know that the kid is not going to be interested in that unless the kid is trained to perceive how the TV advertising.
So you still think it's important for kids to share in that TV body?
It's not, they have, how do I say this, they cannot ignore it. It's like cutting
can't
a kid's
ignore
arm off.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say. It's a new arm, invisible arm, a new lung. You can't stop them.
But do you get a sense, as I do, that it seems that in the consciousness anyway of most people, that the TV body, as you put it, is being demonized nowadays?
That's because it's an old environment.
Right.
The chip body, which has been around for 20 years, has now itself become a familiar old environment, and the new hidden environment, I call it the bodies this technology's came from. That's reality TV. The last 5 years, since 98, has been an awareness of a post-media, post-TV, post-chip body sensibility, which I call the anthropomorphical physical. Our sense of what our bodies are and everything we invented can be mapped back onto the body. But that, as those inventions disappear and shrink and miniaturize, we become aware of where these technologies came from. Let's call that the AP. A good example was September 11th. With all the chip surveillance, all the TV surveillance, supposedly those guys snuck in with cell phones underneath the radar. That represented the AP bypassing the chip and TV organs. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So the general popularity of Rush Limbaugh, Jerry Springer, and spamming is that people can knock this centralizing, conserving TV body. And so in the United States, if Hillary is abused, everybody celebrates her because she has been beat up by the major media, which is the TV body. So that is the theme you're referring to, the demonizing of the older media. For example, you in the TV industry would have to deal with that. I'm just realizing it now. You're an old medium.
Yes.
And so, yes, the people's sensibility, as the chip body becomes more cognizant in the population's mind, that means it's becoming recognizable and therefore not the hidden ground. The hidden ground is never noticed. But if you're beginning to adopt consciously a chip body sensibility and you're against the
Bob, you said hidden ground.
Yes, the hidden ground is the present. We don't fully know right now what's operating on us, you and me, what's happening to our bodies,
right?
What around. That's very hard to be aware of.
That's the part that I'm interested in.
All right, well, I'm always describing that collectively because our physical body, that yogis were really good at intuiting the present effects, is only one part of us now, one quarter. So I'm describing the other parts of our body and how to become aware of the hidden ground. And the hidden ground is the rise of the AP, so you start to see effects in the older noticeable environment, which themselves once were hidden environments, but now are regular, used, cliche, and noticeable. So the chip environment is quite noticeable now, hence the popularity of The Matrix and these other virtual reality movies. And therefore, as people notice it, they say, yeah, I want to take a chip body position. And the chip body position is, it killed TV.
Right.
So let's, and the content of our expression, demonized this old, ancient, homeless medium television. You see what I'm saying?
So that, all of that, the impetus for that is coming from the hidden ground.
That's right, right, right. That's, that, those syndromes, you always look at the symptoms that are in the public, is only recognizing the past, what is obvious. Now, the market, the capitalist print uniform money markets, always look for that. That's the new cool. And it's marketable. As McLuhan used to say, if it's obsolete, it works. Or if it works, it's obsolete. Demonizing the media works. It started working 10 years ago with Rush Limbaugh. And see, talk radio was the interactive chip medium for people who weren't on the computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they were being affected by the chip environment around them and demanded interactivity. So talk radio was brought back. It was a big phenomenon of the 90s. So you could say the red and blue of the election map of the United States is the coasts are affluent people who are on the been involved with the chip body for 10, 15 years, and the middle part, I think it's the red part that votes for Bush, the red pill,
yeah.
That votes for Bush are the supposedly slower, middle America, agrarian, smaller communities, not as high-tech sophisticated, right?
But so demonized by the blue ground as a bunch of gun-loving freaks.
Right. And really what's going on is that the TV is being demonized by the blue chip body guys. Let's not think of it as Warren Beatty or Jack Nicholson or Barbara Streisand. Let's think of it as media dynamics, since human beings are so puny compared to these other parts of themselves. So you look at it as a war between the TV body, the red zone, supporting conservative Bush. Who knows, you just put on a conservative image just to be appropriate on TV, and the White House is a medium that only works under TV conditions. And it's against the blue, the east, the left coast and the east coast, which are the chip high-tech thing, which is going around the whole world. So we have a dynamics there. The red and the blue really represent media profiles, new environment profiles. Now, the hidden ground of all that is that the chip body is happening to everybody all over the world. And so the politicians set up a fake red-blue dialectic for the newspaper world, that old newspaper world of national boundaries. Politics in the White House is a newspaper game, and so it makes these fake categories red versus blue, but they reflect a larger hidden ground, which is what I'm talking about. And none of them could deal with, the red and the blue, could deal with the AP, the hidden ground of the anthropomorphical, surfacing and knocking out the towers in the Pentagon.
As a way of itself,
expressing itself,
express itself,
yeah,
to turn around and make an attack really on the chip.
That's right. And remember, it hit the first building it hit was the one with the big steeple on it, which was the TV tower for
that
all
is true.
Of New York
yes.
boroughs. Beg your pardon?
Yes, that's right.
That's
I remember.
Right. So,
I remember thinking that.
Right. Now, here's the way the language works in this is that it supposedly was the Taliban doing it. Now, we know in Britain the television is called the telly. So you had these guys wanting to ban television. And the Taliban themselves were notorious for not allowing television and music and radio in Afghanistan. So right in the word Taliban, if you had terrorist groups all over the world, all applying to the central headquarters of terrorist control to bomb New York, they would say, well, what's your name? Ah, we're this, we're that. Ah, you're called Taliban, though? Well, you guys get in. That's the right name. We want to ban the television. You see that how it's interesting how language does this as a living organism communicating to humans about what we're doing to ourselves.
Sure.
So
it's a bit corny even.
Oh, yeah, it's literal, or yeah, it's corny. But that's when you're communicating at a mass level, there's so many individual differences. On a mass level, you always have to go to the lowest common denominator so that there's a faint odor of recognition.
Sure.
So that's why media was considered degraded and vulgar, or television was in the 1960s, because if you were a TV exec in 1953, you've got to communicate to all these different various parts of the United States you're going to have to find a common denominator, because the medium is involving everybody, right? So naturally you go to what were lowbrow people like Johnny Carson or Ed Sullivan, you know what I mean? And it's not to disparage them, it's just their image was appropriate for the mass medium effect of television. So yes, the low common denominator is a is another faction, another part of our bodies and sensibility that cannot be just sloughed off, right? But nowadays we know that it's so many niche marketed situations, so many different media that, you know, to being corny is not a problem anymore. The idea is to find differences.
Well, the amazing thing is, you say, you know, it makes so much sense to me when you say it, Taliban.
Yeah.
But who would have thought it?
Nobody would have thought it. You'd have to be British and know about Tally.
Yeah.
But see, I thought of it because, you know, I'm looking at the media not for semantic meaning. I'm looking at the word itself like an art object. And I'm saying, okay, now what is in that word, that phenomenon, that group, that means and reflects the hidden ground? So I'm not doing it to consume. I'm not consuming information. I don't consider any information going to be addressed to me that's going to help me personally.
You're thinking critically about that word.
Right.
Whereas we're taking it as a news item.
Right. You think it's going to have something to do with you and save you. Any real dangerous information will never be told you. Because, first of all, you can't panic the mass medium. You can't panic the mass public. So any real serious thing will never be told to you. All right?
I buy that. I absolutely do. I believe it 100%. And
so all news is static in that sense.
Well, something I've been thinking of, as I mentioned, critical thinking, it's a skill that it seems to me is consciously not taught to people.
Okay, now there's the... Most people think critical thinking in a literate society is some guy who reads a lot.
No. I mean, actually, thinking about what you're being told and what you're, the instruction that you receive from a critical point of view.
Well, okay, but let's look at that. This is a very key point. You know, at what level am I applying critical thinking? McLuhan pointed out in the 50s and 60s that those that were considered critical thinkers, like Aldous Huxley, George Orwell, whatever, Dwight MacDonald, whatever kind of intellectual was around in the 50s writing for newspapers and magazines and books, McLuhan said that was a literate kind of criticality and was no longer relevant to the TV post-literate situation. So McLuhan offered a new kind of critical appraisal of forms, which was not limited to a book sensibility. So I'm just checking to make sure that you don't mean that. It sounds like you don't.
I don't mean that, no.
And that would be natural because you've lived through many environments that McLuhan's generation didn't deal with, and you would naturally think, yes, you must have a media literacy. Post-literate literacy to be critical, right?
Well,
post-media awareness.
My complaint, if you want to say it's a complaint, is that throughout my education in the system, critical thinking or analysis was not taught. And I now realize, or I suspect, as I have grown older and been doing some of my own thinking, that it's left out on purpose.
Yes. No, you're right, because the critical thinking that McLuhan began, and I stand on the shoulders of McLuhan, what I'm saying, is that he said the kids should not be taught any subjects, any separate subjects, like history, math, English, whatever, because we lived in a seamless world of information. He was describing the hidden ground. And that you therefore don't want to teach the kids different categories of information content. You need to look at the form itself. And if people actually did that, it would put the schools out of work. So in a society which is based on fragmented jobs, industrial individual wage earners, it cannot know what McLuhan was talking about. And that's why you were not taught. And you could say that's a conspiracy, but it's not directed by some secret privy council working for the Queen. It is a cultural bias that was built in North America through 200 or 300 years of literacy that the people recognize as their genetic mimic code, their techno code, and it's very hard for society to undermine itself. So they ignored McLuhan and continued teaching subjects. And you learned to specialize in them, and it was totally useless when you had to deal with the world that you had to make money in. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
In terms of critical awareness.
So...
critical awareness is lethal to any society, for the society itself. But today, we're not going to survive unless we have critical awareness, in the sense I'm talking about. Because it's too much, you can't hold on. The the old societies that critical awareness was a threat to don't exist anymore.
Well, now when you talk about survival and threats, what is the danger? What's the danger today for us living in this world where we have to satisfy all of these bodies, or at least juggle them, as you say? Where can I, as a person, expect that the threat might come from?
Well, all the environments are making incredible effects. The symptoms will show up in you. That's the other phone. The symptoms will show up in you, and you may be in the hospital with some kind of cancer when you're 40.
Okay, so you think it can actually physically affect me?
Oh, yeah. My wife as a doctor sees the ill health of 20s and 30-year-old people getting diseases a lot sooner than their parents in all kinds of new forms because their immune systems are damaged. And the immune systems are inadequately described because they're not dealing with how to have critical awareness in relation to our new organs, the TV and the chip body. So there are actions on yourself. You have to work hard at your show, at your TV budget work. There are side effects in your lifestyle that you aren't aware of that are sneaking up on you. And that's just for you and for the physical body. What about the collective society, which has a sense of crisis right now all over the world? Where did that come from? We created it through our new media, our new environments. So, and that's a lethal effect. So, are you thinking that you're not in trouble?
No, I'm not thinking that at all. I'm just, if someone mentions to me, hey, buddy, there's a problem here, the question is, I'm thinking about it from a strategic point of view. What can I do, to prevent this kind of deleterious effect on my person?
Well, the simple point is that you become aware you have four bodies, that you wouldn't be waste mental energy demonizing TV or demonizing the chip or thinking you're going to get something out of the chip or the TV body other than that you have to use them, just like you have to use your arms and legs when you get up.
Stop fighting it.
Yeah. And then watch how other people describe their lives.
Right, but you're not saying stop fighting it in a complacent way.
No. I was going to say the non-complacent in my next sentence, which is study how people interpret what their problems are with this awareness, this chart I'm talking about of our bodies, and figure out ways to tell people how they don't have the critical awareness that I'm assuming you're acquiring right now. It's not that you accept something. Like, when I get in the morning, I have to use my legs. But I can sort of say, well, I'm tired, I'm not going to do too much today. Whereas another day I feel, oh, I got the energy or I need to do it, I'll go out and jog or something. Right? I'm not consistent. But I accept the changes that I feel I want to do with them. That's the way to do it with your four bodies. Now, what's interesting, you still will have to go out and make programming. Or if you were a talk show host, like Matt is, they have to provide guests who say crazy, ridiculous, obsolete things on the radio show. They have to continue providing that obsolete information to keep it going, to keep the radio of Mojo Radio going. Recognize our complicity, our guilt, our sin in this situation, and come up with better ways to discuss it in public. And at the same time, don't use the media as much as you are forced to.
That's a fascinating approach. I would never have thought to accept those things.
Right.
I would have thought that, and my estimation of the work that Matt had been doing thus far, was that what you would be trying to do is incite some sort of rebellion.
No,
but in fact, I must have missed the point.
Yeah, you did. Well, everybody, nobody knows this point that I'm saying. Because the media, Matt couldn't communicate. He tries to do it with all these little asides he makes during the show, which he gets from me. But the thing is that he's inside an environment that you can't communicate what I'm talking about unless you take someone aside like we're doing and spend a lot of time with serious attention on the basics, which I'm trying to stick to the basics so you can get an inkling of what I mean.
Right.
In other words, I'm leading you to a subtle awareness of the situation.
It's Socratic.
Yes. My method is Socratic, but the awareness is not Socratic. The awareness is a sophisticated subtly in terms of juggling your four bodies. And therefore, you know, when I turn on Rush Limbaugh or Howard Stern or anybody, I say, first of all, these people are speaking in English in a world that communicates beyond English.
Right. From square one, there's already.
Yeah, already there's that. So I'm not going to get too involved in the content. If someone's going to ask me my opinion about what the English word said, I say, well, first of all, it's irrelevant what they're saying because it's only limited English. And that's a verbal medium inside a radio medium, which caused World War II and the Depression. And that radio after image is inside a TV world, which is what Howard Stern discusses the celebrities. And that's inside a chip world, which has allowed Enron kind of corporate disappearance of money, which has led to a collapse in the economy, which has led to a war. That's how I react to listening to Howard Stern and Rob and Rush Limbaugh. I just replay the process that we're involved in.
Right.
So I let myself not fall asleep and get stuck. Now, I also can be playful. I can go on Cloak and Dagger and pretend to have a point of view and play with it, right?
Yeah. But heard the show, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not me. You would not know that unless I told you, but that's such a small part of myself that you haven't even begun to talk to the person that I am, which is made up of these four bodies, right? So it's a very, you take a page of Finnegan's Wake, as I always stress, there's a book that describes what I'm pointing to. That is the first book of media awareness. And McLuhan spent his life translating it. And his books are attempted translations. He didn't take the words of Finnegan's Wake and try to figure out what each word meant. He took the message of Finnegan's Wake and translated it into his awareness of the present around him. So that's what I'm about. Another term is, we can call it media yoga. The fact is we're dealing with a cloning of our human ESP, and that's been superseded by the ability to drop out of that cloned ESP through the digital scamming and spamming, which I call voluntary ESP. You saw people in Japan engaging in voluntary ESP. They could engage the old mass media as content on their cell phones and interact with it with quite a physical autonomy. They were not sitting home attached to their telephone, which was attached to a telephone wire, or the TV wire. They could walk around. Look
right.
At mobility. And broadcast to anybody. They weren't even standing on the platform. You saw after images of the old physical body.
I guess what scares me, though, Bob, is that I feel they're gorging on it.
Gorging?
Yes.
Well,
because it seemed to be all that people were concentrated on was engaging that piece of technology.
Well, we look through history, people eat a lot, always eating and gorging. Look at these media as food, as gorging, as other stomachs. Are you disgusted with all the people who are gorging, you know, right now there on Queen Street?
Well, no. I suppose not.
You kind of accept it.
Yeah.
So you see, it is hard to accept the new media as new food gorging. But if you get a detachment about that and an understanding, then you are at square one in how to think clearly about your likes and dislikes in that situation or how you want to orchestrate yourself in relation to it. But I'm giving the bait. I'm describing the water we're swimming in, which no one's doing properly, clearly, definitively, and undeniably and empirically, right?
Right.
I'm not making up stuff. I'm just describing what we do and relating it to old concepts that people think they have about human rights, democracy, alienation, capitalism, communism, injustice, all these old terms, right, which come from a literate phase. They don't apply to today. I mean, to show the effect of radio, has anyone ever told you that the concentration camps, the Holocaust, was a product of radio?
No one said that.
Yeah, not the content. McLuhan said it, but you wouldn't know that. But not the content of radio, but the form itself. The form had turned human biological bodies into subatomic particles, discarnate entities traveling inside the radio interior landscape. Therefore, the old physical body, collectively and subconsciously, was expendable. And the Germans had no problem with killing masses of people because that was just a physical body. They were beginning to unconsciously intuit that other parts of the body had been grown, the radio body. And so the physical body could be thrown on a dump yard. That explains why medicine has gone so pharmaceutical and just dumps drugs into the old physical body. Now, this is not understood, but you can see that media affect people and make them act instinctively, even though they consciously have ideas that they're not doing that. But everybody was shocked at how anybody could be so inhuman to the to the victims of the Holocaust. But the point is that radio for 20 years had been doing incredible things to society. Caused the decline of classical music in the 20s. It created new kinds of music, new kinds of art, which were considered vulgar. It created the inflation and depression. It created tribal warfare. It's incredible what radio did. But the inventor of radio never announced it. Bill Gates never, or was it Steve Jobs, in 1984 when they advertised the PC computer in the Super Bowl in January 1984, the famous originary kind of image of the computer revolution. This ad, Jobs never said that your jobs would be altered by this computer, that society would become weird and bizarre within 10 years in forms of people that you would never recognize would show up. You know, they don't say that in advertising. Look at a newspaper. It's got the good news, which is the ads telling you new products you've got to adjust to, and the bad news. The ecology between the bad news, which gives you the idea you're surviving from the effects of what's around you, the effects that are coming to you are shown in the ads. So the ads are the good news and the regular news is bad news. That ecology is actually a statement of the effect of an environment. You know what I mean? Bad news is not just the statement of the effect. The good news is also, because every new environment has services and disservices. So the TV, the newspaper, is a relevant art form because it shows you the process if you don't get sidetracked into the content of the good news or the bad news. You see the whole gestalt laid out in front of you in the newspaper. And Joyce recognized that, and he turned the newspaper into an art form, and he wrote a novel called Ulysses with one dateline, June 16, 1904. He was just miming the TV ecology. The newspaper and telegraph ecology, because newspapers were telegraph at that point. So he showed the ecology in our situation. I'm showing an ecology, but I don't want to limit it to the word coexistence or equilibrium, because those are just print words or one word, which is not, and no word is adequate for the post-word world we live in. You see what I'm saying?
I do, but I have to say it feels like a bit of a cycle.
It is a cycle, but it's not a cycle of nature or a cycle of logic. It's a cycle of environments. Like my body is a cycle of blood and oxygen and lungs, liver, kidneys, and legs and food, right? It's an organic body politic.
Is this a closed system, though? Is it something with limits, or is it something that can constantly expand or will continue to expand as a form of evolution, as it were?
Didn't they decide just recently that the universe is expanding and not contracting?
They keep changing their minds about that, don't they?
Right. Now, this comes to my opening themes in my essay, Cloning ESP, where the drama of cognition, of perception of humans, is to merge and to block. We need limits in perception. That's why we have a mind. The mind filters our sensory data. You can see that humans filter and yet have to take in new information. The juggling of filtering and finding limits, as well as dealing with the inevitable flood of new, that actual paradigm we have in our organs, in our physical bodies and perception, is now the situation we deal with in our new bodies, our new corporate body politic, where we wonder, can we handle new technologies? And how much can I block? And you can see all over, people are replaying that archetypal drama of cognition, of blocking and merging. You are doing that when you're saying, I've had enough of TV, I'm going to turn it off. You want to block for a while. But that cannot be infinite. You have to reemerge and merge again with your body parts. So this yin-yang dialectic, and I don't like to use that image because that's a simplistic image, but the question of whether we need limits or not is easily answerable. Yes, we need limits, but we are not limited to having limits because we demand new experience. We're contradictions, which comes to my other point. We're double. All humans are double. Doubleness. Norman Mailer writes a novel on this called Harlot's Ghost. The basic doubleness, the basic contradictions of us, these different impulses in us, which are now simulated by the TV and chip body. So now we have four instincts, contradictory instincts, not only the first two of the physical and astral, but the TV and the chip. So we've doubled our doubleness, so we're now quadriphenic. And we come back to what I talked to you an hour ago, our quadriphenic nature.
Mm.
So do they have limits in TV and chip? No, they're just going to keep growing it, right? Do humans have limits in dealing with it? Yes and no. That's the ongoing drama. We have to figure out what the problem is right now to fit this ratio in a particular context. So right now, you're dealing with a guy, a Canadian Commissioner of Privacy, Mr. Wadwanski. Is that how you say his name?
Not sure.
George Wadwanski or Radwanski, whatever it is. Have you been following the crisis in his life?
No, I haven't. That's one thing I don't do is get involved in those kinds of political. He's the guy who spent all the money in the wrong place.
Right.
Yeah, that's all I know.
Okay, there is a particular problem. We could have five different opinions on what to deal with it, like a Cubist painting, five different views of what to do with it. One of it is yours. I don't want to get involved with the guy who spent his money. You have Lenny on the radio saying Wadwanski is a hero. He's protecting your privacy. You have someone else saying, well, George Bush is putting the pressure on Chrétien to get this guy because he's against the Total Information Awareness Project, which is now updated to a new name. The thing is, you see the different parts of ourselves arguing with ourselves and others on any issue?
Yeah.
It becomes noise.
Yeah.
So, therefore, to balance up all the noise, we're going to have more and more high-definition, high-fidelity technology.
Well, one of the things with noise is that to get attention, you need spectacle.
Yes. Spectacle is high definition. Noise is the effect.
Right.
So we're improving our spectacle to the point that someday you're going to meet an exact replica of yourself. You, maybe not you, but your children are going to meet an exact replica of themselves. A clone. That's a high definition version of yourself, right? At the same time, there may be no society. It may be a, what's that Mel Gibson movie, Roadrunner, desolated?
Road Warrior.
Yeah. It'll be a Road Warrior environment, maybe, due to all the wars that came out of all the technologies that we're creating. Our evolution will lead to a Road War environment where you will meet a high definition image of yourself. That's a possibility. You see what I'm saying? That the high definition continues to be developed, and the chaos noise keeps developing right beside it. There's the doubleness in the technology miming the doubleness in yourself. There's only one medium that solved that problem, and only temporarily, when the phonetic alphabet came in, and then the printing, and then the papyrus in the Roman era. Finally, the doubleness that the Greeks could never resolve, they being literate, had a problem with doubleness. Primitive society doesn't have a problem with doubleness. They just live it. That's why they look like barbarians to a walking contradiction to literate people. Think of that movie Black Rose, 10, 12 years ago, of the priest coming into the Canadian Indian world. Remember that movie?
Yeah, Black Robe, yeah.
Yeah, Black Robe, not Rose, right. Very good. It showed a literate person dealing with pre-literate civilized or tribal modes, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, that the alphabetic society, the Greeks, started to have a problem with the doubleness because they could develop a point of view through writing. That medium established visual space or literate point of view. And they've changed their society. They recognized the individual had some kind of democracy and led to Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. But that fell apart because they didn't have the technology to hold it together, so Alexander the Great collapsed. But the Romans had papyrus and developed straight roads, so they developed a literate society that had staying power. Out of that came a means to unify the doubleness, and that is represented by Christians, in particular St. Augustine. Augustine figured out that there was a third term to resolve the doubleness. It was the individual soul, the individual psychology, the Christian development, the Christian idea of evolution. That was a way to swallow the doubleness. And how did he do it? Because the phonetic alphabet, in early written papyrus form, created an abstract space in people's perception. Nobody had ever been able to do that before. It was a product. Christianity is a product of the phonetic alphabet and papyrus. Now, when papyrus was pulled out by the Egyptians, Rome collapsed. And then you had the Dark Ages. And then when the monks brought in newer mechanical inventions at the turn of the millennium at 1000 AD, they were able to rebuild visual space, and Christian society took off again.
So, in a way, the society created by the Christians is sort of a dumping ground for our inability to deal with or synthesize these other two areas of our lives.
Right. The doubleness that's always in people, primitive societies have no problem with doubleness. But they're called by literate people the people of the dream. They're not even to have any individual soul substance. Then when you get literacy, you begin to develop the medium of soul substance. When you get into electric society, in electronic society, the soul substance disappears. Therefore, 1960 Time magazine announces God is dead. That what that means is the visual space phonetic alphabet God is dead. People have been searching since then for all kinds of modalities, primitive, shamanistic, oriental, Asian, whatever, or drugs or media immersion as forms of resolving the doubleness, which would be a problem still for people because we do have a literate background that all of us grew up in as children. So, but it's only a minor thing. So all those people who are into astral projection and soul travel and all this occult stuff, they are trying to save and keep going the little product of the phonetic alphabet. Try to tell that to Robert Monroe or to any psychic guru on the network, that the soul they're talking about is a product of the phonetic alphabet. So what does survive death? If you assume, and I know we survive death, what does? Not the phonetic alphabet, something else. But that never entered here.
And it's not the soul.
That's right. It is something grander, bigger, tinier, whatever. It is the thing that comes into this world, is not part of this world, just registers it, observes it, and then leaves. Because this world is largely, for humans, governed by what humans make, language and technologies. That's what we're discussing here. I'm not talking about your personal soul. That's going to come and go. We're talking language. So there is a form of critical awareness. If we're going to talk about the soul in earthly, secular terms, then you have to see it as a product of the alphabet. So that's a complexity for you to think about.
That's a big one.
That's what we're trying to do here, make you big. But the... So I'm not rambling, though it may on first hearing appear to be, but I'm always trying to guide it to what you want, critical awareness. But those two words do not refer to the yoga you need to develop. And first of all, it's just to perceive the forms around us, which are these miniaturizing bodies.
Right. Step one.
Yeah. Step one is our four bodies. The fifth body, to wrap up here in a way, is the ongoing thing we're excavating, which we have no clue what it is. Every culture...
And that's the hidden ground?
Yeah. Well, I call that the mystery body, which is... existence itself, but I wouldn't put any images or even use that word. We don't know where we were, where we are, and where we're going. And we don't know what the interplay of the other dimension where our soul goes, or non-soul goes, and what it does when it comes back here. We are constantly excavating. We have just discovered, as I'm announcing, that the mystery body at least is made up of what we call traditional physical reality. It's made up of astral reality, and it's made up of TV reality and chip reality. We now have four constituents. We may discover more. I say that the fact that technology is shrinking, we're now moving into the real hidden ground, which is realizing that we are a mystery body. We're just beginning to realize, this is the popular phrase, we can't trust the leaders anymore, we have no role models, nobody can guide us clearly. We are actually beginning to tap into the mystery body, which is just realizing that what we've been excavating has limited our view of the mystery body. You see what I'm saying?
It's defeating itself.
It's been evolving.
It's obscuring it.
Yes, but that was natural. We're now becoming aware of the obscuring process.
I see.
And that is what will be the hidden ground of the next 50 years. Many people will go to church, will do this or that, will express their need for sacredness in some form, but they will know that that is temporary, that they will... really be looking for other things. So for the next 100 years, we are in a quest within this mystery, which we're more and more aware of. And I don't mean a mystical mystery or any cultural meaning of mystery. You know what I mean? My word mystery refers to something I don't know what it refers to. I just know the constituents are being excavated, and there's more to excavate. part of the mystery, will we be able to handle this infinitude of experience? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Your limits question will come in. We don't know how much the mystery body can handle on the limits level. So we're really at a really neat point now, because all forms of information have arrived, have done their duty, have done their thing, and we have found them half lacking and half exciting.
Yeah, and frustrating at the same time.
Right. In another sense, yeah, we're coming back to our doubleness, but we have to include technology's been acting out the doubleness, and maybe the Creator has been acting out a doubleness. So at least we are quadriphenic, not schizophrenic. We at least know that quadriphenia is a guide to excavating the mystery body more accurately. You see what I'm saying?
Mm.
So I'm referring to big processes. My words are limited. I only have a few terms I use. Might take a while to explain them, but I'm only using a key jargon to swallow accurately where we're at today.
And I got to think about it.
Yeah. Which is just processing my terms with your own already established inner terms.
Right.
But I'm asking you to look at your inner terms are largely probably guided by images from movies, images from books, images from music.
The product that is me.
The product that, of all these media that you've been. I'm saying that I'm referring to hidden media that you haven't found ways to see yet.
And that I do understand from this discussion, absolutely.
Okay, great. Now, maybe Matt or Christine wants to supplement what we're saying. I'm not saying we don't have to end now, but I think it's good that we've come to some point.
I got to tell you, I got enough to think about.
Okay.
At this point, I'm afraid to keep going.
All right. Well, if you get a chance, go back and listen to the first 7 dialogues on the Head North site that I did with other people, because I do some of this there, and it'll help you. Or it's a way of refreshing it without hearing our dialogue again.
Understood.
Yeah. You haven't heard them yet.
No, not yet, no.
Okay, well, check them out because they're there, and you're now been number 8, and I think our plan is to go back to those people we've done over the last 5 or 6 months and see what's happened, talk to them again after they've used my stuff.
Okay.
So you'll be brought back in, you know, a year or so, whenever.
All right, no, I look forward to that, actually, Bob. This has been great.
Okay, good. I appreciate you appreciating it, Simon.
All right. So
okay.
Should I pass you to Matt?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
You're welcome, man.
Hang on.
Oh, I always ask I always ask what you do, but we heard a bit about that. That was what was good about your story, is that you were working in this industry that was relevant to our discussion.
Right.
But are you a Canadian?
I am a Canadian.
Where were you born?
I was born in the UK, and came over here when I was 6. With a transfer, my parents got a transfer over here. The land of opportunity, as it was called at that point. And as you know, I work in TV, and my hobby is a pilot.
All right. What school did you college you go to?
I studied film production at Ryerson.
Oh, okay. I used to have a radio show at Ryerson. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not.
Yeah, that was in 87 to 91. So I know Ryerson very well.
Yeah, it was a frustrating place to be at the time that I was there. It felt a little long-winded.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, we're talking about old technologies. Well, film certainly is one of them.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time studying that, something that already passed us by.
Right, and they didn't tell you that.
No, because it would have stopped me paying them the, I don't know, $7,500 a year I was giving them to go there.
That's right. So you need an outsider like myself to come in and tell the truth, and I don't mean truth in the old traditional sense, to tell what's going without any strings attached.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I understand why they have to live in the rearview mirror. Culture's always living in the rearview mirror. Wealth, generation survival is rearview mirror.
Well, there was enough clues for me with the stodgy old props we had. You would have thought I could have figured that one out.
No, but you also were looking for a role within the economic system yourself. So
true.
You put blinders on.
And now guess what? I got it.
And now you're frustrated with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's where real awareness is necessary to get not happier, but to get some kind of slack, we'll call it. You know what I mean? So I'm offering that. So, yeah, it gives you something to think about. To work towards understanding, because that's really what your job is at some point, if you you got economic security is to figure out what the hell the mind was for.
Okay. Yeah.
What thinking is for. So we're updating that. So that's good. So glad to be of service.
Thanks, Bob.
The bill's in the mail.
I'm looking forward to be speaking with you again sometime.
Okay, Simon.
Hang on. Here's Matt.